we can do better. But the way we do better is we take good enough care of ourselves to honestly have the energy and the interest to be concerned about things bigger than us. And that's the territory of a real warrior. What am I willing to fight for and protect? Because it protects my people and it protects my food source, which is my planet, our planet. And that's very, very important.
Welcome to the fourth episode of the Evolve Solo series of Living 4D with Paul Cech. This week, Paul focuses on spiritual evolution. Why is it so important to have a spiritual practice? And how can you create one that supports your dreams and goals? Paul answers those questions in this episode. After you've listened to the episode, join Paul for a special session of Instagram Live where he'll answer any questions you might have about your own spiritual evolution. Stay tuned to the end of the podcast for the time and date of this live Q&A session.
Well, hello. I hope you've enjoyed our 2019 Evolve Yourself series so far. This is Paul Cech. I'm excited to share with you today. This is a topic that's near and dear to my heart, though I do love physical evolution and emotional evolution and mental evolution. Those are all really just aspects of spiritual evolution. So today, in part four of our series, Evolving Yourself Spiritually, I will cover what spirituality is, what love is, and how we evolve in love, the I, we, all of spiritual evolution, the archetypes of human evolution within a lifetime, Ken Wilber's four-quadrant model, which I have modified slightly, and I'll share that with you. And I will finish with how to make your spiritual evolution simple. So I'm excited to dive right in and share with you this most important topic. And hopefully I will be able to inspire you to understand spirituality deeper and be conscious that the process of spirituality is going on 24/7, whether we're conscious of it or not. And that by getting excited and really taking advantage of the magic and the mystery of each of our individual lives, we can all participate and make life much more fun in the present and make it more wholesome for the children that are here and that are coming. So let's get started. So really, what is spirituality? That's a big question, and you get all sorts of answers from different people, like most things. So what I did is I looked through a variety of different books that I have on the topic, which is quite a lot of them, and I chose the definition that I thought was really most in line with my own experience of spiritual development. So in the book Spiritual Intelligence, The Ultimate Intelligence by Dana Zohar and Ian Marshall, they state, to experience the spiritual means to be in touch with some larger, deeper, richer whole that puts our present limited situation into a new perspective. Let's go through that one again. And by the way, Dana Zohar is an amazing author. I think Ian Marshall might be the writer that takes her thoughts and makes them more appropriate for book form, but I think her first book was Quantum Mind, and it was absolutely excellent if you can get a hold of it. It's been around for a while, but it was amazing because it was a book that I just absolutely loved and thought, oh my God, this should be mandatory reading for everybody, but wasn't that popular in the book market. So again, in the book Spiritual Intelligence, The Ultimate Intelligence by Dana Zohar and Ian Marshall, they state, to experience the spiritual means to be in touch with some larger, deeper, richer whole that puts our present limited situation into a new perspective. So when people ask me what spirituality is, I just simplify it to one, being aware of, and two, connecting to a larger whole. So we could think of an onion and our sense of self would be the center. And then a larger whole would be our family, and a larger whole might be our community. And of course, within that larger whole is nature. So we go beyond community, we get to culture, and then beyond culture to the world, which is, you know, inherently an expression of nature. Then we go beyond that and we get to progressively larger systems within systems. So the world's part of the solar system, the solar system's part of the galaxy's part of the universe, and the universe, in my opinion, is part of a multiverse, and all such multiverses are an expression of the one, or consciousness in all caps, or pure potential, or the absolute, or God in as capital G, capital O, capital D, which is differentiated from capital G, little o, D, because those gods are all gods that are different based on different religious viewpoints, and therefore they are potentially ethnocentric. In other words, they can't be capital G, capital O, capital D because they differ. But capital G, capital O, capital D, the absolute, does not differ. It is the ground state from which all things perceptible emerge. So our spiritual reality expands itself progressively until we reach a legitimate awareness of an authentic experience of the ultimate grand union with that which is beyond all ideas or concepts, and unfortunately can't be spoken about, because the instant you try to speak about it, you're already departing from the truth, which is why, as I've shared before, when anyone asked Buddha what to describe God, he just went silent, because he was being honest. So spirituality, then, is the progressive growth of our awareness and participation in a greater whole. Now, I'm going to share a model that I developed that emerged out of my studies of Ken Wilber's work many years ago, too long ago to remember. But if you haven't studied Ken Wilber, I would encourage you to look into his Integral Life membership. The Integral Life community is just like a wellspring of all sorts of very rich, evolved integral consciousness, which is the highest level of consciousness on the planet at the time. And you can get access to a lot of amazing teachings there. I cannot keep up with it all because they seem to produce just mountains of information, but there's a lot of great stuff in there. So in this process of we all, our spiritual evolution of, you know, which is awareness and participation in, progresses in three general stages. First, the I, then the we, then the all. Now, we are actually involved in all of those at all times, but we're less aware and less capable of fully participating at all levels until we first get a pretty good handle on the I, and I'll explain all these, then the we, then the all. Now, as I'm going through these, remember, we don't go from I to we and leave the I behind, or we to all and leave the we behind. As with all conscious growth, we transcend and include. As we transcend, we are capable of more refined holistic expressions of love. So it's also important to know that we can revert backwards. For example, if I'm giving a lecture, let's say, to a large audience of people, and one or more people begin to attack my viewpoints, I may be triggered. And if I get triggered, it means that I feel the need to defend my sense of self, so I could drop all the way back into the I level of self-expression, and there I might you know, I might react or say something that ultimately isn't good for the we or the all. And that's part of our spiritual evolution, is to be aware of what level we are at, what level we're descending to or transcending in the negative sense backwards. And so it is a real lifetime commitment to conscious awareness, which is really what mindfulness practices are all about. So since our transcendent nature and our transcendence process through the I and the we all and the all that I will explain are really holistic expressions of love, then let's take a deeper look into what love is. Now, I researched this. I've studied many, many books on love and scientific books on love. In fact, I even have a book called The Physics of Love, which is quite comprehensive and interesting. I don't know the author's name, but maybe we can find it for you and put it in the show notes. And what I found was that there was a few authors that basically agreed with what my soul had taught me in my meditations. And so I will share what I was given from my time in meditation and talking to my soul about these things. My soul said that the L of love stands for life, but life is an expression of desire. If we don't have the desire to live, well, we all know we can kill ourselves and end our own lives. We can stop ourselves from breathing, so to speak. So the L of love is the feminine principle, or yin. It's that which draws something into itself for fulfillment. It has a positive polarity when we look at it from an electromagnetic perspective, because the positive pole of an electric circuit draws current towards itself. So some of these things are a bit tricky when you get to yin and yang and positive and negative, because they're basically relative viewpoints. So I'm explaining these things the way that they seem most logical in my own perception of it, but depending on a person's viewpoint, that the polarities can be reversed. So the L of love is desire. It's L stands for life, the desire to live, and the desire for anything, love, cookies. I mean, without desire, we would have nothing to live for. The O of love actually stands for zero, or pure potential in all caps, or consciousness in all caps, or unconditional love. Zero is the only number we could use to symbolically express the unconditional of love. Any other number represents a condition. So O equals zero, which correlates with the zero-point field in quantum physics and astrophysics, which is the source of what scientists believe infinite potential, infinite energy, and even infinite information. VE stands for volt electron, and that is actually, interestingly, when my soul taught me that, I went and looked in my science dictionary, and lo and behold, VE is the notation for volt electron, which represents the electromotive force. So light is an electromotive force. The planets are in orbit around each other due to electromotive force. The moon and its gravity pulls on the Earth, and you could say that the energy fields that are involved relate to an electromotive force. Light, as I think I said, is an electromotive force. Magnetism is an electromotive force. So the electromotive force is alive in every atom. It's what's involved in the electrons and their orbits around what we would think of as the neutron and proton in the center of the atomic structure. And the electromotive force is what ultimately manifests as will. So if we look at love, then L equals life or desire. O is the potential that desire draws from, and volt electron is the action of our will, our desire to move toward another person, place, thing, or experience. So it's pretty potent. I define love as the flow of energy and information through empathic and or compassionate connection to self and or other. So love is the flow of energy and information through empathic and compassionate connection to self and or other. I also define love as consciousness becoming aware of itself. And I think both of those are quite applicable. We evolve through three stages of love as conscious awareness on our return route to home. In other words, the source from which we emerged. Now, what I'm going to do is take you through this model, and basically I got the concept of I, we all from studying Ken Wilber, but I modified it to fit better with what I found through my own experiences. And I also developed the love model I'm going to share with you. I was listening to a lecture by Osho many years ago. I bought the entire Osho library probably around 2005. And so I own, I own every book, audio, video, DVD, CD, DVD-R, cassette tape ever produced by the Osho organization. And I spent about 5 years studying Osho every day, and I have about 800 pages of handwritten notes. In one of his lectures, he mentioned that love occurs or expresses in three stages. And I basically took those stages and built a body around them. He just made the statement that love occurs in three stages. Excuse me. Sex and violence loving, followed by conditional loving, followed by empathetic and compassionate loving. So in my model, sex and violence loving is I-oriented, conditional loving is we-oriented, and empathetic and compassionate loving is all-oriented. And ultimately, our progress through those stages leads us back to the truth of ourselves, which is unconditional love or the Tao that cannot be spoken, or the great mystery. So love is the first step of the Czech approach to spiritual living, because a labor of love is sustainable. That's the most important thing. I think we've all had experiences of doing things we didn't love to do. I know as a kid I had a long string of them. And sometimes we end up with people that we don't really love to be with, and that usually doesn't inspire us. Love is sustainable because when following our hearts, we are more inspired to do the growth work necessary to create any dream that fulfills us and gives us meaning in life. All dreams require relationships to fulfill. When we are committed to our dream, we're also committed to ourselves and to growing in all our relationships. When we learn to co-create with others that we love, and they love what they do, then it inspires us to learn and grow together. So we learn how to grow in love. So it's important to remember that when we're doing what we love, what we love to do, and that can be even something that may not be directly related to our dream, but maybe it's a job that's giving us the financial stability to build our dream to the point where we can do it full time. And therefore, we can see that though it may not feel at the time like we're doing what we love to do, if it's facilitating our ability to ultimately do more of what we love to do or focus on that full time, then we carry that love into our relationships. And if the people that we're with are also doing what they love to do, then we get to surround ourselves with people that are in love. And that is how we get inspired to grow. It's my love of holistic health that's kept me in this profession for 35 years and perpetually learning and growing more. And through that growth process, I can share more with my clients and students, and let alone my family, which is important, and even myself, because the more love I have in me, the more whole I feel, the more connected I feel, the more capable of creating joy and expressing free will I have. So now let's look at our spiritual evolution as an I, we, all concept, or from an I, we, all perspective. So I equals engaging yourself in the process of self-awareness, which means learning about your body, listening to your instincts, your emotions, learning how to use your mind, how to heal, and how to create what you want. In this process, we learn that what we refer to as I or self cannot exist without the world, as we talked about earlier, earth, water, fire, air, space, time, and movement. And consciousness depends on space, time, and movement in order to function. So these are important processes. You know, we really gain a lot by fully engaging ourselves, and that becomes more apparent when we get to the we of this model. But until we really learn about our body, we don't know how to take care of ourselves, and until we listen to our instincts, we're not tapping into the power of our subconscious mind, which, as Bruce Lipton says, is about 4 million times more powerful in its processing power than the conscious mind. Until we work with our mind, which was the subject of our last podcast, we can never use our mind to our potential, and therefore we're not likely to heal efficiently, nor be efficient creators for our own dreams, or co-creators for others, or even co-creators for the universe, or co-creators with whatever you believe the source to be. For me, it's God, but not a religious God that has wants, needs, or directives. It's the God of unconditional love. Now, through spiritual awareness of ourselves, we realize ourselves as a link in the great chain of being, which means that everything is part of everything else. And until we realize that, we are subject to the pains of ignorance and are left with a never-ending series of question marks, such as, who am I? How did I get here? What am I? And what will happen to me when I die? If we don't engage in a spiritual life, seeking the greater whole and finding ourselves within it, then we're prone to feelings of isolation, victimhood, and unfortunately an emptiness that is not filled by materialism, consumerism, or any other ism. Inevitably, we find that rank, power, money, fame, and so-called success do not fill the emptiness within us. Just look at the anxiety and depression and suicide, for example, amongst rich, famous, and powerful people and seemingly intelligent people in the world who climb the ladder of success to the very top, only to realize that their ladder was leaning against the wrong wall. They were not fulfilled. In fact, many of them were so empty they committed suicide. So we may be individuals, but we cannot fulfill our spiritual growth potential or contribute optimally in relationships until we become whole. That doesn't mean we're not in relationships or we're not whole. It means that we have an opportunity to become whole. And as we become more whole, we have less and less confusion or conflict or chaos within us, because, as I will share in a minute, the process of becoming whole means to have clear recognition of what thoughts are your own versus someone else, what ideas are your own versus someone else's, what values are your own versus somebody else's, etc. Now, Jung called the process of basically becoming whole individuation. And it's important to remember that two halves do not make a whole in relationship. An adult relationship requires two individuated or whole people if we want to get past the pettiness of sex and violence loving, which I will go into shortly. In regards to what individuation means, Carl Jung said, "I will try to explain the term individuation as simply as possible. By it, I mean the psychological process that makes of a human being an individual, a unique, indivisible unit, or whole man." So that's a very, very important distinction. It means that we're capable of taking responsibility for our thoughts, words, and deeds. It means that we're not falling into the victim archetype and blaming everybody else for how lousy our life is, or that we're not complaining when we're prostituting ourselves and doing things for money, or that we're not sabotaging ourselves, or that we're not acting out the eternal child archetype, which leaves us in a codependent relationship with other people, meaning that we become, in some ways a burden on them, or we fall into the psychological developmental stage of the child. And, you know, age is not relevant here. People can be in the child archetype their entire life. People can be victims their entire life. They can sabotage themselves their entire life. They can prostitute themselves their entire life. The problem is that if we don't listen to the inherent wisdom within our heart and our instincts and our body and the symptoms it's providing us and the messages that reoccur in relationships such as divorces and losing jobs or losing friends or losing our money or giving away our time and the challenges that creates, then we start getting more and more bitter. And oftentimes we get bitter with other people as a projection so that we don't have to deal with our own bitterness within ourselves, towards ourselves, or for ourselves. And that, if it's not handled, can be the source of a myriad of various forms of physical, emotional, and mental disease situations. So now if we just go back to our numbers that we have been working with through the series, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and look at how our evolution through the stage I'm here referring to as I, your individual evolution, relates to those. It is our individual task to identify and align ourselves with what I call our one love or our chief dream goal or objective, something that gives us a reason to go beyond our habits that may be self-limiting or our limiting belief systems or our codependence upon others or our feeling of frustration with the work that we're doing in the world. Two is all about balancing the feminine and the masculine. So it's up to us to look into ourselves, as I shared in part 1, 2, and 3, and identify where we are out of balance. And then three choices, the optimal, the suboptimal, and do nothing, those choices can only be made by us as an individual, whether that be in relationship to ourself, in relationship to things that we're having challenges with, such as addictions. And remember, an addiction is any repeated behavior that does not produce the results you want. Then we get to the four doctors, which is our core values, and we have to have core values, or we can't evolve spiritually, because remember, your yes has no value until you learn to say no. And without clearly defined core values, then we end up saying yes when we should be saying no, and saying no when it might be wise to say yes, because we cannot clearly make these decisions for ourselves, which means we are still a child and we need to ask somebody else what to do all the time. And this is one of the problems in our world today and why it's not evolving as efficiently as it could. And that is because so many people still put themselves in the child position with regard to scientific researchers, doctors, and experts of all sorts. And instead of actually doing the work to investigate opinions on both sides of any belief or proposition or things like vaccination, abortion, gender, sexuality, you know, how we use our money, how we manage the material resources of the world, what we should do with nature, then a person still has not grown themselves to be mature and responsible for the decisions they're making. Once we look at and give our ear to experts on both sides and ask ourselves what rings true for me in my heart and what, if lived, produces more wholeness, more connection, more love, and more safety and security for all living beings, then we can grow. If we're not responsible for making dream affirmative decisions with our five program design factors, time, energy, willingness, finances, and resource availability, then inevitably we're going to default to someone else making those decisions, or we won't make them and we'll find that we're just not accomplishing very much, whether it be an exercise program or a healing program or a program that you write for yourself for, you know, getting something done, like your daily goals. So then we have our six foundation principles: nutrition, hydration, sleep, breathing, thinking, and movement. Only we can monitor our own breathing, our own thinking, and take responsibility for our own movement, be it physical, emotional, or mental. And we are responsible for relating to ourselves effectively enough to identify what food quality and what food choices are ideal for us. And again, reading diet books and following them like gospel is the act of a child, because that's allowing somebody else to tell you essentially what worked for them. And the common mistake made is if the keto diet helped me lose weight or feel better, it must be good for everybody. If vegetarianism or veganism helped me get over cancer, well, it must be good for everybody. But that totally overlooks the fact that we're as different on the inside as we are on the outside. And inevitably what happens is all these approaches to diet are really just a very poor approach and a very slow approach to metabolic typing or individualized eating. So the very foundation of our individuality rests on taking responsibility for getting clear on what our dream goal objective is or what nightmare we need to address to free up a lot of energy we can use in positive ways, identifying where we're out of balance, what choices we need to make in relationship to four doctor values, identifying what is the ideal approach to you know, executing the things that we know we need to do in order to live more fully, grow more fully, and evolve, and then take responsibility for those six foundation principles. Now, with that in mind, we will look at the archetypes of evolution of the self. Now, the self is the I. So what I did after years of study and reading, you know, a lot of work on archetypes and human growth and development and stages of evolution of the human being and many, many related topics, I basically looked at what I found in all these different areas and summarized them into four stages that we all grow through. And these stages go hand in hand with spiritual evolution, because as we grow consciously into each of these stages, then we are evolving. So the first stage is the child. We are all born as children, and we need to be taught how the world works and to learn what is safe and what is dangerous and, you know, the things that a child has to learn to be able to ultimately become an adult and navigate the world and minimize its chances of, you know, painful or even devastating experiences. And that form of our development correlates to sex and violence, love. So I'm sharing how it correlates, but I will expand on each of the stages of love in a minute. The warrior is when we go through puberty and we decide that we have different ideas than mom and dad or family. And maybe we find that, you know, they're very frugal, but we don't like to be quite so frugal. We want more freedom with our money. Or maybe they're very squanderous of their money and that causes a lot of stress in the relationships in the family. So we realize as we go through puberty that we don't want to live that way. Our parents may be very dogmatic about certain religious viewpoints, but we may find that that does not work for us. For example, you know, if you look at, you know, say traditional religious values, be it Christianity or Judaism, for example, and in other religions, having sex with other people before you're married is often frowned on. But in today's world, you'd probably find yourself having quite a challenge to get someone to say that they'll marry you until they've had some time in bed to explore sexual compatibility and chemistry. Because there's many cases that I know of people that get along and they can climb mountains or drive around in cars or even create things around the home or in a business relationship, but just have terrible sexual chemistry. And the people that I know that have gotten married on those pretenses ended up often getting a divorce because they found that there was such a huge vacancy in their intimate life, their sexual intimacy, that it led them to either feeling that they needed to have sex outside the relationship, which for them was too stressful, or they did it and it led to a breakup. So the key point is when we go through puberty, we become a warrior first fighting for what we believe in. So we have got to identify who we are as an individual or we can't evolve. All we can do is be a photocopy of mom and dad's genes and beliefs and ideas. And that inevitably leads to a collapse because as Buddha said, the universal constant is change. And if our ideas don't evolve as the environment changes, be it the natural environment, such as the place you live in, or the earth as a whole, or the environment of technology, which we've seen rapidly change. I mean, when I was a kid, I remember when fax machines first were around. I remember the first cell phones. I remember the first time computers were on sale. So, you know, as a soldier, I've seen the evolution of military technology. We've got what we call evolution in food technology, but for the most part, it's devolution. So, you know, you could look at the many ways the environment changes is what I'm saying. So the warrior stage is where we engage our environment and learn what it is that we need to learn to be effective in the world, to create our dreams, and to be a contributor. And in that process, we learn what we're willing to fight for, metaphorically, stand up for. What are we willing to put ourselves on the line for? All warriors in tribal societies went through an initiation process, and that initiation process was designed to make sure that they were ready to die for their tribe and protect the tribe at all costs, or life could perish. So we, in the warrior stage, evolve ourselves into a self-conscious individual that becomes aware enough to say, what am I willing to devote myself for or to, because it's important enough to me to die for? And that's the stage of conditional love in my model. and I will expand on that. Once we become a warrior and we get some experience under our belt, which usually takes till about 35 to 40 years of age, in my opinion, we can then transition into or evolve into what I call the king or queen stage. The king or queen, and now each stage you go, you get less people actually making the transition effectively. Many people, for example, go through puberty but do not become a warrior and identify what are their own values, what are their own desires, what are their own beliefs, and what are they willing to stand up for. So they just become, you know, they fall into sheep herd mentality. And you see this a lot with, you know, anywhere where you see a lot of people, but the fundamentalist religious expressions are usually highly programmed people that don't really think for themselves or question their own thoughts and beliefs or even investigate the sources and the history of their own religions or, God forbid, look at other religions to see if there's anything exciting and interesting and beautiful there. So the king and the queen, being the third stage of evolution, in general, means that we've become very proficient at what we do. We are making a significant contribution in some way to our family, society, and culture. So the king and queen stage emerges when we have our own home and our own property, and we pay our own bills, and we are not codependent upon others to make it in the world, meaning need handouts from them or keep running to them because we can't get our act together. Now, there's a wide variety of kings and queens. You have kings that are kings in this stage because they have their own household and they may be an employee in a company somewhere, but they may have a wife and kids. And so the king and the queen rule their own domain and they're individuated people. They're whole people and they're clear about their values and they're clear about making a contribution to their family and to society and to the world. Oftentimes their sense of clarity is distorted because they haven't emerged in the final stage of our development, which is coming up. But we have lots of kings and queens that fight for all sorts of things, and that's how we get wars. And if you look at Donald Trump, he might be in the king position. He has an idea of what he's fighting for, but unfortunately, his ideas, if executed, create more and more division. If a king or a queen divides their own people, that's basically sex and violence loving. So we do have kings and queens by the standard term, but the question is, are they awakening? The next stage is the wise man or the wise woman. So the curve of simplicity to complexity reaches its peak at the king or queen stage. And then we often find that we've built up a life that's too demanding and too complicated, and that oftentimes we have to inflate our ego by, you know, grandstanding or marketing or doing the things that we think we have to do to get everybody to look and to buy. And this is inherently part of all of our lives in some way. But, you know, I'm sure if you just look at the media, you'll see all sorts of king and queen behaviors out there that may not necessarily reflect a great level of wisdom, but that does reflect a great level of complexity. So imagine being, imagine being someone like Steve Jobs, right? He was the king of quite a large organization. He had a hell of a lot of money. He had a large empire or reach, but he had a really hard time getting along with people. So when we look at the next stage of development, well, first of all, what I'm showing you is the child is very simple. The warrior becomes more complex than the king and queen. They're the epitome of complexity. They have to have a lot of knowledge and be aware of a lot of things. They tell the warriors what to go fight for and who to kill, so to speak. So, you know, the general has to have more wisdom than the guy on the front line. So the king and queen opens the door to the realization that we've built a life that requires more time and energy than we have the willingness to do, or that we're surrounded by all sorts of material riches, but we're not happy or whole on the inside. And that opens the door to the emergence of the second simplicity, which ultimately leads us to the real meaning of the second coming of Christ, which is realizing our oneness with all that is. The wise woman, wise man, the wise woman can also be referred to as a crone, and often is referred to as the crone in various psychological literature and other literature, is at the level where empathy and compassion, or empathetic and compassionate love, the third stage of the love model I'm sharing with you here, matures, and we can begin our capacity for empathy and compassion in the king stage, because by the time we're a king or a queen, we're usually old enough to see our own childish behavior, our own insecurities, our own jealousies, our own fantasies, our own denials manifesting in those that are less experienced or less evolved or younger than we are. And there's where we begin to have empathy and compassion, because we can find ourselves in the other. Empathy means to feel, empathos, to feel, and compassion means to understand the other. Now, at the wise man, wise woman stage, we begin to progressively grow in our capacity for empathy and compassion, and to see ourselves and others, and to see ourselves in the world. And for those who are legitimately practicing empathy and compassion, they are more likely to have experiences of the all or unconditional love, which is the ultimate calling of the soul. The soul is unconditional love within us. It is consciousness, which is a product of zero, a product of pure potential. I could go into this in great detail, which I do in my more advanced training, and we have talked about these concepts to the degree that I can in a series of, you know, a short series of podcasts. But ultimately, it is the fact that what gives us the ability to be conscious of, the fact that you're conscious of me talking, means that you have consciousness allowing you to be conscious of as an individual unit of consciousness within all that is, or the divine mind, if you will. So once we start growing spiritually and learn to relax ourselves and aren't so addicted to beliefs and behaviors that are rigid, we can begin to have experiences of dissolving. We may be standing on top of a mountain looking out over a valley, and all of a sudden we become the trees, and we become the air, we become the river, we become the birds and the bears and the bees and the flowers and the trees, and we have profound mystical experiences. We may be making love to somebody, and through intimate contact and harmonizing breathing and movement and eye gazing, and through orgasm, we can completely lose not only all sense of self, but we merge with the other so fully that there is no one there. Yet everything is there. And we realize that God loves to make love. I think most of us have figured that one out. I mean, most of us have, hopefully. So there you see, our spiritual evolution begins as a child, learning about life through sex and violence, loving. We grow into a warrior, which means who am I protecting and what am I willing to fight for or give my life to in devotion. That's the stage of conditional love. Then we become a king or a queen, which is we awakening to all through empathetic and compassionate love. And then our life gets too complicated and too exhausting, and we realize, oh my God, I created such a big ego demonstration of myself, I can barely prop it up. And if we can't deal with that, well, ladies and gentlemen, that's what's called a midlife crisis. A midlife crisis is when you are at a point where the person that you've created out of yourself is no longer fulfilling, but you're unwilling to do the work to change the beliefs and the behaviors that led to the feeling of loss of self, separation, or being unhappy. And often that's coupled with blaming your partner that your life is shitty or something like that. And so it can be a functional equivalent to the dark night of the soul, where we have this sense that everything's dark and any sense of guidance that we once had seems to be gone, which is usually because we're exhausted and our bodies aren't healthy and we're entangled in all sorts of relationships we don't want, and we go to work and relate to people from that place of being less than whole. And of course, that leads to the mirror working more effectively than we like, and people mirror back our own pettiness or our own short-temperedness or unwillingness to be present back to us, and we then have an opportunity to engage it and grow, or just blame everybody else, and then we just go deeper into a spiritual crisis. So we love, remember, I love is self-love, and we love is, you know, it's love of others, love of it, love of persons, love of places, love of things. So it's, if we take a second here and look at the love model before we move further, sex and violence love is the love of being a child, where we come into the world and we have to learn about fire. I think I've mentioned that in Sharp Things and gravity and falling and the things we've got to learn in relationships. Conditional love is basically categorized by statements like, I love you if you do such and such, I love you when you do such and such, I love you and then dot, 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 you better do this, I love you but. So if, ands, or buts are conditional statements. So whenever we're in conditional love, you see it expressed as contracts. Well, we have marriage contracts, we have rental contracts, we have, you know, employee contracts, we have legal contracts for all sorts of things. I mean, even buying music or downloading things off the internet. So we see at that love level, we are getting clear on what we need or what conditions we need to be met in relationship with other people to enhance the likelihood of us feeling harmony together. You know, when you rent a car, there's conditions. But if you go crash the car and bring it back beat up and expect not to have to pay for it, well, then you're still a child and you shouldn't be driving a car and you shouldn't be signing contracts and you're not very evolved. So conditional love's all about getting clear what circumstances allow you to love more fully and feel safer in relationships. So it's a very important stage. And here you see that correlation to the warrior, because if the warrior hasn't got a set of values yet and doesn't know what it is willing to stand for, to live for, or to die for, then how does it really know when to say yes or when to say no? And therefore, it doesn't know what conditions are ideal for it in relationship and often ends up in the wrong place. And I can tell you, as as a guy who was a soldier in the 82nd Airborne Division and worked with soldiers from many branches of the military due to the work I did, and even after the military and still to this day, the number of people that join the military thinking they're just going to get some fancy education and get fed all the time and have their bills paid and their medical covered, but do not factor in the reality they could end up in a battlefield getting shot at or blown up is pretty high. And I've worked with PTSD patients that came home in shock from just that. They really thought they were joining the military for the things I mentioned, but never expected they could be in a battlefield. So that's what happens when you're not clear about the decisions you're making or the conditions you need to feel safe and to create more love and share it with people and relationships. The next stage is empathetic and compassionate love, which, like I said, is where you begin to recognize the pain and the challenges that others have are the ones you've also endured, and you realize it's part of the stages of growth and development, and that even when we thought we were smart and capable, which is really common in our 20s and 30s, we realize we didn't know near as much as we thought because some kind of deal that we're doing goes very wrong, or we lose a lot of money, or we end up in a divorce only to realize later that the person that we treated so poorly is the one we love the most, and now we go running after them and find out they're in another relationship and have to often deal with very, very painful heartbreak. So empathy and compassion really is a mature form of love, and it's very, very tricky because, remember, we transcend and include. So at the level of empathy and compassion, we come to some painful awakenings, such as sex and violence lovers like drug addicts and people that are addicted do not value empathetic and compassionate love. They will just walk all over you. They will ask you for money or favors or get you to do anything they can do until you're blue in the face. So if you just give out empathy and compassion and try to be loving, but it's not skillful, you ultimately find yourselves in situations where your emotions are challenged and your confidence in people is challenged, and you start descending back to conditional love. And if that isn't carefully managed, then you end up right to sex and violence love. And so now you've lowered yourself right to the level of the person that you're having a challenge with, and things can get hot. Now, we could be the greatest lover in the world, but if somebody wants to hurt our family or breaks into our house when we're in there or tries to mug us, we may have to drop back into sex and violence loving as a means of protecting ourselves. But we may be conscious enough that we're trying to create a condition for everyone's safety, which is why Kung Fu evolved, so that the Shaolin monks could not hurt people that were trying to hurt them, but disable them just enough to protect themselves and minimize the harm to other people. So all stages of love, from sex and violence to empathy and compassion, can be used skillfully or unskillfully, and that's part of our evolution. And it takes a lot of awareness and a lot of practice and a lot of commitment to your own growth. But the energy spent on being aware and committed and mindful pays off a thousandfold, because you don't keep going backwards and reliving Groundhog Day, and you learn when certain people aren't compatible with you in relationships, personally, professionally, or spiritually, and you know that they just need to go out into the world and do what's working for them, but that you can't be part of it anymore. And it takes a lot of maturity and bravery to know when it's time to cut off relationships, whether they're personal, professional, or spiritual. So now that we're discussing we love, it's important to remember that each we is composed of two I's. So if I'm in a relationship with you, I am half the relationship and you are 50% of the relationship. So because we're 50% of any relationship, which means that we have to be 100% present to provide that 50%, we find something interesting, which is a real big problem today, And that is this. If you're even 10% deficient, let's say you're having a meeting with your spouse to discuss your family's finances, and you're not there 10%. You're thinking, I got to hurry up and get this done so I can go out and golf or play tennis or get rush off to the next meeting. Well, the problem is that being 10% not there does not create a 10% deficit in the relationship. It creates a 20% deficit in the relationship. Why? Because there's 10% of you that the other person cannot access. So 10% of you is off being somewhere else. That's a 10% loss, and that 10% is not accessible and it certainly isn't devoted to the topic of the meeting. So there's a 20% deficit. Now, if you want to see how significant that can be, if you are a pilot and you were leaving LAX headed for New York and your bearings were 20% wrong, you could end up not only in the wrong location, but in the wrong country or, you know, in the middle of the ocean, running out of fuel. Map program or your Waze program was 10% off, that could be a real problem. You could miss the most important meeting of your life. It's 20% off. You can end up in the wrong city. If you're getting investment advice and there's a 10% or 20% deficit in the relationship, well, then you could lose all your money and that can be a real problem. Maybe one that you don't want to engage in. I've seen it happen to a number of people. I've had several professional athletes now who got totally ripped off by their managers and lost millions of dollars, and it really wounded them, and that's part of the reason they were seeing me for therapy. Their whole career started to break down due to the stress and their relationships. One of my athletes had $4 million stolen from him, and believe me, it made him bitter, but we worked through it. So many feel it's narcissistic to focus on. It means overly self-centered to focus on what's self. But let's hear what Jungian analyst and professor of Jungian psychology and one of my favorite people to study, James Hollis, has to say in this regard. Basically, what James Hollis shares in his book, Tracking the Gods, The Place of Myth in Modern Life, which is a very, very excellent book by James Hollis, but I would warn you that it's very, very deep. So if you don't have a background in mythology or a significant amount of studies in religion, it might be just way over your head. But I like to share resources so that all of you can be inspired to grow and study. He shares the four principles inescapably present in relationships. So to begin, one can achieve no higher level of relationship to another than one has achieved in relationship to oneself. So that says your capacity in any we relationship is limited largely to your own capacity because you can only engage the person at the level that you're at. Now, if an angel comes along, somebody who's willing to help you and nurture you, the angel in this situation being the more evolved person is very likely to give you an opportunity to see where your thoughts, feelings, and behaviors and choices are limiting you for yourself and in the relationship. But there's an old saying, don't mess with angels because they have a high sense of self-value and sense worth. And when they come to realize that their time is not appreciated or their efforts are not appreciated, then they flap their wings and fly away and you're stuck back with poor me again. So relationships are always implicitly contracted at the level of the psychological evolution of each of the parties. For this reason, relationships are frequently rent by heartache and blind conflict as one outgrows the earlier level of contract or is blocked. An attempt to evolve. So to break that down and help you understand what Dr. Hollis is saying, let's break it down. Relationships are always implicitly contracted at the level of psychological evolution of each of the parties. It means when you enter the relationship, you were at a certain level of psychological evolution, and that's what attracted you to that person. For this reason, relationships are frequently rent by heartache and blind conflict as one outgrows the earlier level of contract or is blocked in the attempt to love, which means if one of you evolves more than the other one, I tell people you can't get more than one arm's reach away in your own evolution or you lose the other person. And the chakra system, if in relationship to other people, your consciousness evolves one chakra above, you will find it very, very hard to enjoy being around those people. This is one of the reasons that hanging out with our parents can be so challenging, because if you're a healthy person and you go out and engage the world and evolve yourself, you can find that as people age, their belief systems get very, very rigid and they're very unwilling to entertain other viewpoints. And it is the function of a child to evolve beyond their parents for all the things reasons I've been discussing. So you can clearly see when you go back into the environment of your parents and you say, you know, boy, I really enjoy smoking pot. And all of a sudden you get hell and damnation thrown at you, or I have two wives, that can fire the old family structure right up. And then you see all the rigid beliefs come out where they're being held, for example. So you can see that he's saying here, we must be conscious of the fact that the relationship began at the level of which we contracted each other. So when you said I do to each other in a relationship, you were each at a certain level. But if you don't grow together, then one of you is wanting the old you to be there, but that contract is outdated relative to the reality of your own personal, professional, or spiritual growth. You can have the same experience in companies, for example. I used to work for the largest physical therapy clinic in San Diego, but after 4 years, my values were being challenged by the values of that company. That company was far more oriented in making money than it was about being ethical and moral to the customers coming in there. And when I was being asked to do unethical things for money, I could not participate. And so there you see, when I came in, I wasn't aware of these kinds of things, and I was 4 years less developed. But as the business got challenged financially, I saw how my boss's beliefs and behaviors reverted backwards to an I-oriented, not a we or all-oriented stance. And I felt it was safer to risk my financial safety and security and go off on my own, and I and a partner started my own physical therapy clinic, which we had for about 3 or 3.5 years before we sold, and then I started the Czech Institute because I found that the entire physical therapy institution was caught in a belief system that was not serving people effectively, nor was the medical system at large. So there you see another example. Dr. Hollis also says, what we do not know or cannot face about ourselves, for example, the mythologems, complexes or emotionally charged centers in our psyche cultivated from traumatic situations in our childhood and in life in general, that drive us are projected onto others. So I'll break that down. What we do not know or cannot face about ourselves, which is called the shadow, for example, mythologems, which means elements of your story, complexes, which are emotionally charged networks of neurons that create artificial intelligence that tell us things that aren't true because they're usually based on traumatic or fearful experiences or programmed beliefs. Therefore, emotionally charged centers of our psyche, cultivated from traumatic situations or in childhood or life in general, that drive us, which means what we don't know or can't face, including our shadow behaviors and unconscious behaviors that are driving us, are being projected onto others in relationships. So whatever we don't like about ourselves or we don't want to look at, we deny or we repress, but we project onto other people. So an example of that is, as I mentioned in a previous podcast in the series, if somebody's gay or really oriented towards same-sex relationships, but let's say they're in a Christian family or they're a member of a Christian church, and believe me, I've had patients that suffered from this tremendously, quite commonly, then you can find yourself at anti-gay rallies and bashing and criticizing and even writing articles and being in the media, as has happened with various politicians, only to be found out that you were in the closet about being gay and you were just like the very people you were bashing. That's projection. So when you project onto others things that you don't like about yourself or aren't willing to face, then you're in a situation that leads to a lot of pain for you and other people, and it is an indication of a need for legitimate spiritual evolution, or you can find yourself getting progressively more isolated, or the only people that'll hang around with you are people just like you. And in fact, Rudolf Steiner says in his teachings, I think he mentions this in his book At Home in the Universe by Rudolf Steiner, the first thing that happens when you die is you find yourself surrounded by people just like you, and you stay with them until you're absolutely sure of what you will never do again, i.e. in your next lifetime or future lifetimes. Dr. Hollis's next of the four principles inescapably present relationships is that power insinuates itself into all relationships. That means each of us has power drives, and we're inevitably going to use those power drives to try to get what we want. But if we're not conscious and we don't have a clear understanding of the conditions by which the other person feels love or willing to participate, then when we start insinuating our power, it leads to stress and it leads to the feeling of disrespect, abandonment, and a lot of other negative things. So we need to be conscious at the we level that how we express our power either is or isn't congruent with the values that have been established or need to be established in the relationship. If we don't have values, we don't have a structure to control the flow of energy, and power is the expression of energy. A car with a lot of horsepower produces a lot of energy. A person with a lot of power can do a lot of things, whether that be mental power like Gandhi or physical power like an Olympic weightlifter or emotional power like Thich Nhat Hanh. Those are forms of power. So our evolution is to learn to use our power drives to create harmony in the world and in our relationships and within ourselves, or we're not evolving. The fourth principle, individuation, is not self-indulgent, but in fact enhances the quality of the self, the I, we bring to the other, the we. So it means that the more you honestly work on and in yourself to grow yourself, so that you can love yourself and appreciate yourself and value yourself more, the more love, appreciation, and value you have for others, because the more you realize about yourself, the more you awaken to the truth of the lives and the reality of other people. So those are four principles inescapably present in all relationships, which is, at this level of our discussion, the we level of love. Now, it's very, very important that we realize that relationships are the ultimate temple of spiritual evolution. We can go to churches and temples and synagogues and hide in caves all we want to, but relationships are really the ultimate, because it is only through relationship that we can see or learn about the parts of ourselves that are unconscious or that are shadowed within our nature, and we all have them. It's just inherent in the way our brains are constructed, the way our minds are constructed, and what happens when we have an ego. Now, you know, those of you that have been married and gone through a divorce or that have worked with people and have realized that relationships are real work would also be aware it doesn't matter what your degree of education is, how fancy your degree is, or whether you're the preacher, the pastor, or the bishop. Relationships are hard work, and the only real demonstration of evolution is that you realize you're doing better in your relationships and you have more skills to manage yourself and manage relationships, and you're more conscious about what values you need to live, and therefore are conscious of what kinds of people share those values so you can have harmony in relationships, and there you have conditional love. Values are a means of establishing the conditions by which you will allow energy to flow through your body, mind, and therefore how you will invest your spirit. Now, recently, Tammy Simon, It Sounds True, released a interview with Father Thomas Keating, who is a famous Christian priest, bishop, I believe, a very high-ranking Christian, and somebody who I really love. I learned about him from Ken Wilburn, and he really helped restore my faith in Christianity, I'll tell you that. I really, anyone that follows me knows I have a sort of a knee-jerk reaction to industrialized Christianity and all the religion bashing and, you know, bashing other people's beliefs and saying if you don't take Jesus Christ as your Savior, you're going to burn in hell or there's something wrong with you and all that. That's just sex and violence, love full on, and it's poor Jesus must be rolling in his grave watching all that stuff. But Father Thomas Keating was a legitimate Christian. James Finley is another one whose work I've studied, and Matthew Fox is really, you know, a shining example of what a Christian could be, as is St. Hildegard of Bingen and Meister Eckhart and St. Bernard and others that I've studied. I mean, there are amazing, amazing Christians out there. But in her interview with Father Thomas Keating, she was kind of poking him a little, and she said, and this was an interview that had been recorded like 10 years earlier, but she saved it and released it because he just recently died. And she sort of, I'm paraphrasing here, but she was sort of saying, well, isn't it kind of like a retreat to go into monasticism so that you can get away from the challenges of actually having to do the work of being with people? And he just broke out laughing. And remember, he's a bishop, so he's in charge of all sorts of monks. And he said, are you kidding me? It's like being in 15 broken marriages at once. So what he was saying is, even in a monastery, there is no hiding from the work of relationships. And all the, you know, spiritual books and Bible reading and whatever you have really never replaces the work. You can easily become an intellect. Carl Jung said intellectualism is a common cover-up for fear of direct experiences. So people just hide behind fancy words and memorizing passages and all that. But spiritual evolution requires that you actually put those things to work and test them and weed through to find out which ones bring you wholeness, connection, safety, security, trust, and open you to the greater whole and the beauty of everything that's going on here. So now if we look at our numbers 1 through 6 and how they relate to the we, well, number one, what do you love enough to change for? Remember, if you have a big enough dream, you don't need a crisis. We quickly realize that there's no way we can create any meaningful dream without relationships. Somebody built the computer or the phone you're using. Someone made the toilet paper you wipe your backside with. Somebody made your shoes. Someone built the car you're driving. Someone built the dishwasher. Someone is involved in everything that we do. And inevitably, we find that we can't navigate life alone. So though it's up to us to identify what our dream is, it's also us to identify who we can do it with and who can inspire us in the process. Whenever there's a relationship, number two applies, because there's always a yin-yang balance in relationships. There's a dominant and subdominant. In some areas, one partner may be dominant, and others the other may be dominant. When it comes to finances, my wife is the king and I'm the queen. I don't mind making money, but I really don't enjoy managing and counting it. My rule is if there's not enough money for me to live the way I want to live, then I'm simply not making enough money, and that's my issue that I've got to get doing something about. So there's a balance in relationships, and it requires conscious effort and mindfulness and real commitment, which is why we need to be conscious about who we get into relationships with. Most people think that they're getting into relationships because they're going to make their life easier, without realizing that if you get into a relationship with the wrong person or you jump in too quick, well, remember, based on attachment syndrome research, and Diane Poole Heller talks about this in her work, most people's attachment syndromes, their challenges from early childhood that are affecting how they relate to people, don't actually manifest in the relationship for about a year and a half. Takes about a year and a half for the marketing campaign and the sex to wear off before you really realize who you met and the work of a relationship begins. And that's where we have an issue of balance. And the only way we can balance ourselves in relationship is to make choices. And the optimal choice is the one that's best for everybody in the relationship or on the dream team. The suboptimal usually gives us instant gratification but causes problem in relationships or on the dream team. And doing nothing is only productive if you're using that time to gather more information or take a break, because you can't go any further with your partner without losing connection or having the relationship start to break down. So you'd call a timeout and gather yourself and continue once you're centered. We can't have a healthy relationship unless we have harmony and values within that four doctors. You know, many people get into relationships and have wild, passionate sex lives and even get married before they even realize they don't have the same values on a lot of levels. As Sherry Tenpenny said in my interview on vaccination, she said a lot of people don't realize that they have opposing views on vaccinations until they have a child, and it can be a real barn burner in relationships. I know of many situations where people were dating and the female got pregnant and she wanted to get an abortion because she didn't feel it was the best time for her to be pregnant and that they weren't ready to support a child, and he was dead against it, or vice versa, and that has been a barn burner in many relationships. And in relationships, we all have to be conscious of time, energy, and our willingness. Remember, I told you about my stepfather's willingness concept in washing the dishes. So we have to be conscious of time, energy, willingness, finances, and resource availability, because we can get into trouble in relationships because we don't make enough time for them, because we don't have enough energy for them, because we have not managed our finances effectively. It creates problems in relationships. In fact, I think my mother and father probably fought about money shortages more than most things. And so we have time, energy, finances, willingness, and resources. If we run out of resources in our relationship, that creates stress, and you know, you're back in the old temple again, trying to figure out who God is. And then nutrition, hydration, sleep, breathing, thinking, and movement, if we don't manage those and we can't bring a wholeness to the relationship, we're always in a codependent position trying to rescue somebody else. We're trying to help somebody heal. Now, that's fine. That's part of a relationship. But if we clearly know that the reason they're struggling is because they're not managing themselves well, and they're just choosing not to be responsible for themselves, and that puts a tremendous burden on us, and most of us have a breaking point and can only go so far. So when you you know, look at all these foundation principles, nutrition, hydration, sleep, breathing, thinking, and movement. I've been brief because I don't want to be, you know, too redundant, but I think you can see that they're very important in relationships because there is what nourishes the relationship, what hydrates the relationship. I talk about, I have a downloadable audio called Sex as Grease or Sex as Glue. And if sex is grease, then it is healthy in a relationship and it creates a reconnection, especially after, you know, challenges in the relationship. But if sex is glue, it means that sex is binding you to somebody else and they may be codependent or their values may be in conflict with yours, or you may actually just be too codependent on them and believe that nobody else will love you. So you stay trapped in the relationship and the sex becomes glue. And that's something I would encourage all of you to meditate on who are having sex with other people. Is this glue binding me to somebody that I'm not truly in love with or committed to growing spiritually with? Or is it grease and it's bringing us greater connection, love, and harmony that helps us grow and therefore is hydrating the relationship? Sleep. We all need to sleep or we can't be present with each other. And that's obvious, but sometimes the relationship needs a sleep too. Sometimes we need the freedom to go on vacation alone, to just be with ourselves. And a lot of times people in relationships have a hard time with that. They think it is some kind of a criticism or an indication that you don't love them. For example, I've coached people who were having challenges, usually women, because their husband was so domineering and so controlling and so jealous and insecure that I remember one woman couldn't even go to take an education class without her husband going. And it was really hard. And I was also coaching him, so I encouraged him to give her the freedom to breathe. So there you see the relationship has to breathe as well. And that's very, very important to understand. The thinking I touched on with values and belief systems, but a relationship also has to have healthy movement. If you stay stuck, you're not moving. So moving is, in this regard, evolution. And then we also have to look at how our emotions move in a relationship, and is that healthy? A general rule I learned from my relationship studies, because I have to do so much of it, because relationship problems turn out to be a very common source of illness and disease in patients that I work with, is that, I brain farted, so I'm sorry, but it'll come back to me. I forgot exactly what I was leading to there, but I was talking about the importance of relationships and not binding the other person, but I'll just move on to the thought I was trying to convey, which is sometimes we need to have a sleep in the relationship or a break from the other person and get away just to gather and be ourselves and center ourselves, because otherwise we can't be 100% of our 50%. So, you know, that's very, very important. And the movement element is again, everything's moving, and you're either moving towards evolution of the physical body. You know, if you don't keep your physical body healthy, your partner may lose sexual attraction to you but still love you, unless they're at the sex and violence level of loving, which is, you know, eye-centric and body-oriented and things like that, then they may not stay in the relationship with you. But we have to, you know, in a healthy relationship, metaphorically and literally, we eat each other. So if what's coming to the love table isn't so edible anymore, it either indicates that there's a crisis of self that person needs support getting through, that's not taking care of themselves, or there is just a lack of respect or just an assumption that now that I've captured you with your wedding ring, I can just let go of myself. And that's quite common. You see that a lot when people get married, about within about a year, they just look like, what the heck happened here? So movement, as it relates to keeping the body healthy, managing our emotions, which can take a lot of coaching, and that's really what my Check 4 Quadrant coaching system is all about, because it takes you into a deep assessment of yourself and gives you the tools you need to work with others. And then movement of our mind, which is obvious after listening to the previous podcast, I hope. So we have movement at all three levels, and we also have to remember that we feed our emotional body emotions, our physically body food, and our mental body thoughts. And the relationship has to be considerate of what are the similarities, but what are the differences? And we need to be able to support that in the partnership, or we don't evolve, we devolve. Now, the next thing to remember is a paradox. So here's a paradox for you. There is no I in we. Yet, paradoxically, there is two I's that make a we. And as I've stated now several times, the health of each I determines the stability and the compatibility and the survivability of the relationship in many regards. But there is no I in we means that whenever we're in a relationship, there's a compromise. And if we don't take care of ourselves adequately enough to really contribute to the relationship, we don't have the energy and the flexibility, physically, emotionally, or mentally, to make a compromise in honor of the other person's needs. And I could give you a long, long laundry list of where compromises become important. Sex life is just one of them. Finances is another. Time is another. So what you see emerging here is that there is two eyes, but in a relationship, the barriers have to get softer, or there really can't be a relationship. It's just two people living together, cohabitating, and having sex. And that just leads to a flatline experience that most people can't sustain, because they start to break down, because the soul in you knows when you're stagnant. And what happens is we start having physical symptoms in our body that reflect to us where we're holding on to things that we're not able to effectively process. We have to digest our emotions. And if we're having a hard time digesting challenges in our we relationships, it can literally mirror itself as indigestion in our body. And we can run around taking all sorts of pills and supplements and digestive enzymes and parasite cures, yet it seems like we can never get rid of the stomach or the digestive trouble, because we're not conscious that we're actually getting symptoms that we're not able to digest something emotionally or mentally. Each organ has an emotional and a mental correlate to it. If we're constipated all the time, it may be because we're anal retentive. We're holding on to fixed beliefs, fixed values, fixed opinions, or a fixed mythology or story that isn't moving with the flow of the relationship, or with one of the partners evolving, or with society or the world. Now, in a we relationship, there's always what's called a third created, and the third is the product of the two of you. So whenever we get together, Jesus said, whenever two or more get together in my name, I will be there. What he means is whenever two or more people get together in the name of love, then a higher consciousness emerges. Remember, Jesus Christ was one who was united with the all. So he is speaking from the consciousness of the all, i.e. unconditional love. So whenever we get together in relationships, there's a third created, and the third is the product of the two of us, and it's greater than the individual eyes in the relationship. So for example, when you know, my wife Penny is what I call, you know, I refer to her as the mother of the Czech Institute, because without her, it wouldn't be here. So whenever we get together, there's something beyond both of us. Somehow we inspire each other to learn more, to grow more, or to get up off our backsides when we're feeling lazy, but we know we need to do things to honor our commitment to the Institute and to people and to the world. And you'll find that in healthy we relationships, when you're with the right person, usually when one's down, the other one's up and tends to pick you up. And we vacillate back and forth between the highs and lows and supporting each other. And the third that's created is the love in the relationship that's beyond both of us individually, but is an expression of us collectively. And when we come to realize the importance of that third element, it actually becomes a form of love intelligence that emerges beyond our individual capacities. And that's when we have chemistry with somebody. When we have chemistry with someone, magic happens and we solve challenges more efficiently. We grow more efficiently. We love more effectively. And our challenges become opportunities for growth instead of things that we remember to torment the other person with. Now, before we move on to the all, I would like to share that there's only four possibilities for spiritual evolution for relationships when relationships are getting challenging. And remember, there is no greater place for spiritual evolution than in a relationship. You're far better to skip church or temple and spend time at home having heart-to-heart conversations about how to handle your problems than you are to go read a bunch of scripture and be told what to do by somebody else. Because if that was working, then the world would be a lot different place and there would not be so much violence in families, particularly those that are claiming religious affiliation. If you look at Basil van der Klok's work, I think his book might be titled When the Body Says No. It's been a long time since I read it, but he states that he shares the statistics of violence in relationships, and it's shockingly high. And I know from a lot of work with people that are religious people that particularly, as I've mentioned, I think earlier, that in Catholic families, I saw so much violence as a child toward the kids, so much physical beatings. I was amazed. It made me feel sad, but it made me realize that I wasn't in the only family like that. And there's a lot of violence towards children about what God wants or doesn't want and how you'll burn in hell if you don't do this or don't do that. And so we can get ourselves in a lot of trouble in relationships that doesn't seem to be rectified by going to church, because there seems to be plenty of problems in the church. Wherever there's human beings, there's relationship challenges. So I have nothing against religion. If it's legitimate religion, I'm just simply saying, sometimes we're far better to spend time with each other and listen with our hearts and find out what the person's wants, feelings, and needs are and share what ours are and offer the individual a specific request so that at least we give them an opportunity to decide if they can provide what we need to feel more connected in the relationship. So when relationship challenges emerges, the four possibilities that we have are: one, work on ourselves, and that's the best place to start. Two, work on the relationship. The reason that isn't number one is because until we've worked on ourselves, we're usually not clear what we want, because we can't know what we want any better than we know ourselves, and that in and of itself is a big challenge in a lot of relationships. So we can work on ourselves. We can work on the relationship. In other words, make the relationship sacred and more important than our individual needs to the degree that we can make a healthy compromise in honor of the relationship. Three, we can do nothing and know that yesterday equals tomorrow. In other words, nothing will change. So I often have people do what I call the crystal ball exercise. And I say, look into your magic crystal ball and tell me what happens in 3 months if nothing changes in your relationships. And it usually doesn't take them much to do that. And I say, now put your awareness in your body. What's happening in your body 3 months from now? And people say, well, I feel like I'm getting sick, or my back is hurting, or my neck is hurting, or my heart is very heavy. Then I say, what does the relation look like in 6 months? And we do it again. What does it look like in a year? We do it again. What does it look like in 3 years? Well, some people get even to a year and say, I won't even go that far. I already know right now I can't take it. Something in me is just going to break. So option one, work on yourself. Option two, work on the relationship. Option three, do nothing and know that yesterday equals tomorrow. Option four, get out of the relationship. And there is a time and a place for that. Not everybody's ready for a relationship. Not everyone's willing to grow with us in relationships. Sometimes we were unconscious when we got into a relationship, and we become more conscious of what we need and then realize that our partner isn't really equipped to share that with us. So there's many, many pathways here, and I've worked through this with a lot of people, and I've worked through it in my own relationships. And I have gone through a divorce because it became clear that we weren't capable of giving each other what we needed. But I didn't want to limit her from finding someone compatible as a partner to her. And I needed the freedom to find someone compatible for me. And my mission was the Czech Institute. I needed somebody that was mission-oriented. And after a year and a half of meditation each day and going through my list of all the things that I needed in my partner, she manifest one day after me having a vision of her. 4 days later, we were engaged, and we just had our 22nd wedding anniversary Friday on March the 29th. And Penny and I have had a very amazing relationship, and she's really given me more love than I even knew I could get from a woman. And so, and she allows me to share myself in relationship with Angie and mother our child Mana, which, you know, is Penny's really the second mother to. And she's grown with me in ways that I didn't even know a human being could do. I think she's really a Buddha and a mentor to me in many ways. So when we do get clear on what we need, and we meditate on it, and we ask Great Spirit for support or the universe, and we're patient and trust that the universe has to move a lot of things around. I found Penny in Australia, but she lived in New Zealand, and I'm from San Diego. So a lot of things had to move. Think of all the things that had to align for one human being from a country 12 hours flight away to meet me in a country 16 hours flight away, on the right day and the right time in each of our lives. And she was in a relationship with someone who thought they were going to get married, but the intensity of meeting your soulmate is enough to break any bond that is not a soul bond. And so after 4 days together, we got engaged and then got married. And what an amazing gift. And I used Yogananda's soulmate's prayer every day. And that's for those of you looking for your soulmate. This is how it goes. Bless me that I choose my life companion according to the laws of perfect soul union. Paramahansa Yogananda. In fact, if you have not read the book Autobiography of a Yogi by Paramahansa Yogananda, it is definitely one of my top all-time reads. And if you get the audiobook, it's narrated by Ben Kingsley, and it is absolutely excellent. So once again, Yogananda's soulmate prayer, bless me that I choose my life companion according to the laws of perfect soul union. Bless me that I choose my life companion according to the laws of perfect soul union. And it works if you're really ready to get clear on what you need in partnership and what you bring to the relationship. Most people just know what they want, gimme, gimme. But it's as important to remember that love is a boomerang. If there's not reciprocity, if there's not equal give and take, then relationship problems emerge. So that's critical. Now, when we come to all love, in my model, all love occurs whenever there's three or more people together, such as a parent with a child, teachers, leaders of all types are automatically at the all level. So when we're boyfriend and girlfriend or husband and wife, but we're single, we're still tasked at the we level of responsibility. But once we have a third person involved, now we're tasked at the all level, which is why being a parent is a very high spiritual calling. And the more people that are involved, the more the spiritual responsibility is. Why? Because what you're incongruent with multiplies itself at the all level. So if I'm teaching 100 students or 1,000 students something that I'm incongruent with, or that I'm making up, or that I don't really know for sure works, but it's just the flavor of the month out there in media silliness, then I actually can generate karma for myself. And karma means the law of action and reaction. If I misinform people and they run around and hurt other people or hurt themselves because they trusted in me as a teacher or a leader, then I'm accumulating karma. And in this case, negative karma. And remember, because God is a sphere whose center is everywhere and circumference nowhere, whenever we throw the boomerang of love, which means how we relate to self and others, it always comes back to us because we are actually the center of the entire universe. That's worth meditating on. God is commonly described by very intelligent people as a sphere whose center is everywhere and whose circumference is nowhere, which means no matter where you are, you're in the center of the universe because you're obviously a conscious center. If you're listening to me now and you have a body and you can make choices, then all your experiences are only possible because they're happening within you as a perception. So you are the center of the universe with regard to how love works and how karma works. And everything that we put out makes its way home because a sphere, even though its circumference is nowhere, is made of an infinite series of spheres, and each of us is one of those spheres. Everything. Every sentient being is, whether they're an insect or a bird or a whale or a dolphin or a chimpanzee or a human. Now, in his teachings, Rudolf Steiner says that if what we do is harmful to others or harmful to life, but we're genuinely unconscious, like a child who maybe doesn't realize that, picking up a toad and sticking it in the fire to see what would happen is actually going to kill the toad, or somebody who's doing a business deal and they did their best to inform themselves, but there was a hidden X factor that they honestly could not know about, such as a stock market crash. Because it's unconscious, Steiner says the universe absorbs the karma. But whenever we're conscious, and we know we're doing something that isn't what we're saying it is, or isn't true, or we're masquerading as an expert when we're not, and it causes problems, then we have to absorb the karma of that. That type of love, that sort of sex and violence love, makes its way back to us in some way, shape, or form in our lives. So when we're loving at the level of all, it also includes the planet. It includes all life forms. As we grow in love of all, we grow just past myself and two others to include all people, all life forms, the planet itself. And then we have all people and belief systems. And when we reach the all level, or the level of empathetic and compassionate love, which is inherently the all level of development, then Ken Wilber reminds us there's a little bit of truth in everything, meaning that, you know, it might drive you nuts to listen to fundamentalist Christians tell you you're going to burn in hell, but there might be a little truth in there. In other words, the address for hell is the same as heaven, right between your ears. And if you're putting yourself in hell and doing things in the name of God that are not loving, then you're already in hell. You know, you've got the address, you're there. So there may not be this hell, damnation and fire, but we might be doing that to ourselves, and therefore the devil's work is already done. All love brings us into coherence together, and from that place we experience union. Union is the ultimate experience of wholeness. It is the magnum opus of the alchemist, to come into union. And that is really what an enlightenment experience is, or a satori experience of union with all. I've had many of them, and they're mind-boggling. No matter how many times it happens, it still just blows your mind. The mind works in polarity. It works in complementary opposites. Thought requires movement. So when you go into a union experience, there is no mind. There is experience and there's awareness, but there's not judgment. And it is very, very powerful. And those are sometimes called enlightenment experiences, because they inspire you to a higher truth and a higher level of awareness that leads you to the ultimate experience of wholeness, which is realizing yourself as one with all that is, and that there is no gap between you and what people call God, if they really understand what God is. God's breathing your breath and using your voice and looking through your eyes, but God cannot come to know God without experience, and God is not afraid of the dark. God is not afraid of what we call evil. If there was no evil, there could be no free will. Just as if there was no up, there could be no down. And if there was no in, there couldn't be an in without an out, or a he without a she, or a mother without a father, or a child without parents. So when we reach that level of union, which has happened to me, my first real union experience is when I was actually teaching two of my students how to meditate, and I was 35, I think, 35 or so. It was in the very beginning of the Czech Institute, and we were back in those days. I was at 609 South Vulcan Street in Encinitas, which is about half a mile's walk from the Self-Realization Fellowship Temple, where Yogananda used to live and where he wrote the book, The Autobiography of a Yogi. And I had a favorite meditation seat right overlooking the beach on the cliff there. And I taught these guys how to meditate, and then I dropped in with them. And about, imagine, 10 or 15 minutes in, I had a profound, profound experience of literally feeling myself in and as all the stars and all the space in the universe. And it was just so mind-boggling, but I didn't at the time realize that I wasn't the stars and I wasn't the spaces. I was also this guy sitting on a bench meditating. And when it dawned on me, I had a profound experience of falling back into my body from this great expanse of everywhere and nowhere at the same time. And it was like someone hit me with a lightning bolt. And it was quite funny, because I jumped and I kind of made a noise like, oh my God, what just happened? And the other two guys jumped at the same time. And they looked at me and they go, what just happened? I said, well, I just had an experience of becoming one with all that is. It was profound. And they said, And they were twin brothers, and they both said at the same time, "So did we." And so, how's that? Their first time meditating, they had a Satori experience, a oneness experience, or a samadhi experience, depends on how you use the words. And then you can have these things with various shamanic practices, rattling, drumming, angi, and I have had many of them. And then, of course, if you add plant medicines to that, they open the doors. But if you're not ready for that, it might be opening the door to hell, not heaven. So that's another 20 podcasts right there. So we're moving along. So now if we look at loving by the numbers, well, one love, if we're loving at the all level, how does our dream enhance life for everyone? How can we share our love and what we learn through the process of creating for everybody? Where do we all need to look at the imbalances that we're creating together, particularly with the planet, and the imbalances that we're creating with other? We still have lots of warring and genocide going on. We still have lots of racism going on. There's still a lot of sadness and ugliness in the world that we can help God grow into evolving through. Because even though God's got an unadulterated commitment to both sides, the light and the dark, through our own evolution, that part of God awakens to a higher understanding and connection to and realization of what God is in each of us. And that is directly recorded by the universe as its own growth, because we are the universe. It's not out there. It's also in here. What choices are we willing to make together? And that's what politics is supposed to be for. That's what a democracy is for. But if you look at how rapidly and United States and other countries are becoming fascist states that are really controlled by corporations, all you got to do is look at to the vaccination issue and how many websites sharing true and holistic science, looking into the danger of these things, or people sharing their painful and challenging experiences with their kids getting injured, etc., are just getting shut down willy-nilly by the controlling forces out there. We've got a lot of work to do together. When we look at happiness in the world, quiet in the world, rest, we have a world that's just not resting. We're torturing nature with constant buzz and constant lights, and now 5G phone systems and all sorts of other things that I'd love to be able to talk about but can't in this short podcast. But when we look at how we're using movement positively and negatively, you know, do we really need to use fossil fuels to fly jet aircraft all over? Remember, the average tomato travels 1,500 miles by the time it gets to your plate. So think of the carbon footprint on one tomato. Yet Tesla showed us how to cultivate energy out of the atmosphere and transfer it for free, but had his patents removed and his technology stolen by Westinghouse and related people so they could capture energy and sell it to us for billions and make billions off of copper wires and all the other aspects of it. And now you pay for energy and all sorts of things that we really have the technologies not to use. So the question is, how far do we keep going before we stand up for the world as healthy warriors and protect the life-giving planet that keeps us alive? And then we look at nutrition, hydration, and sleep, breathing, thinking, and movement, and look at that from a larger perspective. What are we teaching the children? What are the corporations inspiring us or encouraging us or tricking us into do? And how is it affecting the way we breathe together? All you got to do is look at the fact that the oxygen levels are dropping and the toxicity in the air and the water and the earth are at dangerously high levels, higher than they've ever been. Great Barrier Reef is dying. Oceans are dying. I won't go in a long detailed explanation, but I think it's obvious we don't have enough people that are evolved in their consciousness, particularly at the level of corporations, to think past how much money they're making to what the impact is on all of us, including nature. So we've got to learn progressively, and it's my dream that through the kinds of education I'm sharing here and the resources I'm sharing and just hopefully inspiring you to become a healthy individual, because then you are changing the all for sure. Anything you do to evolve yourself, you're doing to evolve all human beings and the planet, because we're all linked together. We all breathe each other's air. We all drink from water from the same source, the earth. We all eat from the same soil, the earth. And the way we poison in our backyard ends up in another country in no time through the hydrological cycle and the movement of the air and the jet streams. And we know that from Fukushima and nuclear meltdowns and all sorts of similar things, oil spills. But we can do better. But the way we do better is we take good enough care of ourselves to honestly have the energy and the interest to be concerned about things bigger than us. And that's the territory of a real warrior. What am I willing to fight for and protect? Because it protects my people and it protects my food source, which is my planet, our planet. And that's very, very important. So getting toward the end now, I'm going to take you into a breakdown of Ken Wilber's four-quadrant model, which is how spirit unfolds itself. So spirit is the action force of life. Spirit is that which animates and informs. Soul is that which experiences. So if you want an analogy, you have to breathe to get enough energy. I've talked about this in previous podcasts, the paramagnetic, diamagnetic relationships, prana, and those types of things. But when we breathe or do or eat good food or sleep, we charge ourselves with more energy, that energy spirit, and that energy allows us to have experiences, and it is our soul, our inner self, which includes our body, our emotions, and our mind, and our intuition, and our creativity. And our soul is what's having that experience. And our soul is the information gathering system that is feeding through spirit that information back into the earth or the world and the universe. So remember, we have a collective unconscious, and we have morphogenic fields, guiding fields of guiding intelligence. All of our individual experiences from soul are actually in a real-time exchange with the whole universe itself. We're all sharing information, not only with ourselves, but with the planet, with the solar system, with the galaxy, and with the universe. So it's a giant information of a giant experience of self awareness. The universe is, in metaphor, God experiencing itself. So, Ken Wilber's four-quadrant model, if you just draw a cross in the middle of a square, then break it into four quadrants, you will have the upper left, the upper right, the lower left, and the lower right quadrants. Now, I've modified the model to be more inclusive of the teachings that I think are important. So at the very top of the box, I have Eros, which is the masculine expression of love. And at the bottom, Yin, I have the feminine expression of love, Agape. And as I spoke of earlier in this series, those two forms of love interact with each other as male and female. Eros, outgoing, expressive, the sphere or the sun, and Agape, the ingoing and that which holds things together, the feminine, which is represented by the square, which is a symbol for the home and the earth element. So your first understanding here is that all life experiences happen because of the flow of the love that is represented as Eros and Agape. And remember, love is the flow of energy and information through empathic and compassionate connection to self or other. So basically, love is God relating to God, which manifests as separate entities that are perceptibly separate, but that's the illusion that is created so that love can actually work. Because if we did not have the perception of separation, there could be no I-thou relationship or subject-object. When I say, I love you, Penny, or I love you, Angie, or I love you, Mana, or I love you, Mom, or I love you, Paul Jr., I am the one saying that. It's a subjective feeling that I have. You can't weigh it or measure it. But the object of my love is whoever I mention in the sentence. So I love you, Penny. She becomes the object of my love. And that allows the flow of energy and information through empathic and compassionate connection. If you say, I love myself, then their flow of energy and information through empathic and compassionate connection is inward to what you perceive to be yourself, which for most people is their body. So in the middle of my four quadrant, I have a picture of a heart that I stylized to have the Tai Chi symbol, in which there's a dotted circle, which represents that which is behind all manifestations, or the Tao that cannot be spoken, which is essentially, in the language of Plotinus, the source of the world soul, but in his language, world means universal soul. In the upper left quadrant is the quadrant of I am. So who am I? And that includes your inner sense of self. That's the domain of your soul. And that's your consciousness within. It's the I. It's the spirit. It's the subtle. It's the soul and the spirit nature within you expressing itself as life through you. It includes our intentions, our thoughts, our emotions, our feelings, and our values. The upper right is the personal exterior, and that's the I do in my system. So I am, and whatever you think you are comes from your inward awareness of yourself, and I do is the outward quad, outward expression of the self. And so that's all physical expressions of ourselves, our height, our weight, our joints, our muscles, our glands, our organs, anything that can be weighed or measured technically, be it hormonal assessments, postural assessments, structural assessments, electroencephalograms, electromyograms, MRIs, if it can be captured on film of any kind or measured as an evoked potential, it's an expression of the personal exterior because it can be objectified. So it also includes behavior because we can film behaviors and classify behaviors and evaluate behaviors. So interestingly, that's the one domain that medicine is largely focused on. We no longer have doctors of the soul. Once religion and science split, we no longer had physicians that were trained, which used to be priests, to deal with the pains and the challenges we felt inside. So now you go to the doctor and he says, oh, you have high cortisol levels, but never has any interest in how they got high, just offers you a pill to make them go down. The shaman used to be the soul doctors, and the medicine man used to be a mix of soul doctor and body doctor. So this is one of the reasons we're seeing this massive return of shamanism, because religion is no longer effective at nourishing or being a source of medicine for the soul. And because the medical system is just becoming more and more and more techno and gadget oriented, we are paradoxically having more and more tricks and pills and surgical procedures and magic gimmicks, but we're getting further and further away from being conscious of the thoughts, feelings, and beliefs that are leading to the choices that are resulting in the pain. So the upper left is the inner I am. The upper right is the outer I do. It's measurable. The lower left is the we share. So that's where we have family and friends and coworkers. And the we relates to all the people that you're in relationships with. And oftentimes the problems that we're having on the inside that manifest, as I said earlier, as a stomach ulcer or digestive trouble are actually problems that we're having in relationships with our family or our spouses or our lovers or our coworkers, etc. And we have a field called psychology, yet it's in a culture that believes that seeing a psychologist means that you're a mental case. So we don't really value that very well. And unfortunately, our academic systems at large do not require that the psychologists grow and heal, and there's no measure and there's no real leadership in most schools of psychology, so there's not enough wisdom in the hierarchy to evaluate whether or not a psychologist is really a whole person. Unlike Jungian psychology, where you have to go through 4 years of analysis by a skilled Jungian analyst that's already been analyzed, to be a shaman, you'd have to do a very long apprenticeship and demonstrate your authenticity and your ability to do the work of a shaman before you could be given the rites and practices of a shaman. So the lower left is we share, and it is the collective interior, so it's the soul of a group. Then at the lower right-hand quadrant is the collective exterior, so the top left personal interior, top right personal exterior, bottom left collective interior, bottom right collective exterior. This is the zone of we use or its. So we have I at the top, your interior and your exterior, we at the bottom left, and it at the bottom right. If you want to make a triangle inside that box, you could do that. So we're all engaged in the collective exterior. It's the structures. It's the systems that we use to guide the flow of energy and information. It's laws, rules, regulations, and anything that directs the flow of energy. So it's actually the entire planet. So if we thought of it another way, the I am is the person who's acting out the role in their own story or their own myth, which is expressed in the upper right, because there you see the behaviors. And then the we share, the collective interior, is the cast and the crew in our individual and collective stories. And the lower right, we use, it's, is the stage on which we play out the great drama of life together, where God experiences itself and grows its own wisdom and experience and authenticity, because without that, God can't know God as anything beyond an intellectual concept. So when we look at this four-quadrant model, which is, you know, and you, if you get into my Czech four-quadrant coaching mastery system, which people in the Czech Academy and all level fours go through that training, you can see there's a lot going on here, because this four-quadrant model captures everything that's possibly happening. There's nothing in the world that you can be aware of that isn't happening within you, and nothing that's happening in you can happen without an effect on your physiological systems, upper right, and anything that's happening in you can be shared consciously or unconsciously with everybody else. Remember, one mind, we're all connected, whether you know it or not. And we all have an impact on and use the planet and the world stage. And there are now many, many things that are threatening the survival of life itself on this planet due to unconscious choices that are not very spiritual. Those choices are giving us a chance to take responsibility for either being passive and allowing it to happen, or being active and knowing that our voice matters and that our choices matter and that we are a living example to others. spiritually speaking, the greatest lover is the silent lover and the greatest teacher is the silent lover, which means that to the degree that you are living a higher structure stage of consciousness, if you're living at the we level of consciousness, then you're a teacher to all at the I level. You've transcended but included that stage. If you live at the all level, then you're a living example of all at the we and the I level, if you've transcended and included I and we to be a legitimate all. If you're a sex and violence lover, then there are conditional lovers and empathetic and compassionate lovers that can support you. And out of the evolution from I to we to all, our heart grows and our empathy and compassion grows, and we see ourselves in everything and everyone and in all living beings. And that's when we begin to have enlightenment experiences where we undeniably see, feel, and know to the very core of our being that we are one with all that is, and that our choices do matter, and that how we manage ourselves is either exemplifying what we want to see more of in the world or know that we need less of in the world to bring balance and harmony so that our kids have a chance in the future of being something other than a bag to stick vaccinations and drugs in and keep the rich people rich and the poor people poor and that kind of sad story. So thank you, Ken Wilber, for your genius. So closing up now, we've had a good run here. Let's talk about how to make your spiritual evolution simple. So I've got 7 things that I use as my own guiding principles and teach my students. And because I teach them to people, it is my obligation to myself to practice them, or I can't feel good in myself. And when you don't feel good in yourself, you usually don't sleep well, and you usually have eating patterns that reflect that, and your body mirrors it back, and your relationships mirror it back. So the first way we can all practice living spiritually and evolve together is whenever you're facing a choice, whether it be what kind of food to buy, or whether you should buy a gas guzzler or an eco-friendly car, or whether you should bite back after someone says something nasty to you, or whether you should make sure that the person you've divorced knows and everybody else in the world knows how much of an ass they are and things like that. So the question we always ask ourselves, if we're spiritually awake enough to think and count to 10 before we react, instead we respond and we ask the question, what would love do now? Would love punch the other person back? Or would love seek to understand what it is that they're needing or wanting or feeling, and how we can better support them? These are very big steps. Most of us have a real hard time with these things. Remember, Jesus said, if someone hits you in the face, turn the other cheek. And that's the true Christian way, not bomb the shit out of them. So you meditate, if you really want to grow spiritually, just I encourage you to meditate on all the ways you can apply the question within yourself, what would love do now? Is that taking more drugs to cover up your problems? Is it lying to people? Is it buying machines and things that are putting more carbon into the atmosphere that are unnecessary? Each of us needs to really be honest about asking what would love do now, and look at it from the perspective of I, we, and all. And your level of spiritual wisdom and authenticity will determine how you respond when you ask that question. Next, the question that you ask yourself, is the decision I'm about to make bringing me closer in relationship to those I love or who are on my dream team? In other words, am I making suboptimal decisions for instant gratification, or am I going to make a decision that may have may need to be discussed with everybody first, or am I about to make a decision that's going to create disharmony amongst those that are supporting me in the process of creating my dreams? And remember, whoever's supporting you in creating your dreams, they're on your dream team. So in some way, it's their dream too. My wife Penny's dream and Angie's dream, my second wife, is to support the Czech Institute so that it can support people all over the world. And we do our best every day to live the values that we teach and work through our challenges together as mature adults and to raise our kids together and to support each other. And yes, we have challenges just like everybody else does, but we don't run from each other and we don't throw sticks and stones. We breathe through it and take timeouts and work through it and grow. That's the beauty of relationships. And as I've told many of my students that start asking me questions about having two wives, well, I want to do that too. I say, remember, until you can ride one horse really well, it's very dangerous to try to ride two at once. So there's your next spiritual evolution tip. Most of them just want more sex, but you better to do that yourself, and you don't have to get yourself in trouble because it's a big commitment. Number three, if everyone in the world were to do what I'm about to do, would the world be a better place? I'll give you a simple example. I live in California, and even in the dead of summer when it's so hot and dry here, if you even think about a spark, it might light a fire. I have seen numerous people throwing cigarette butts out their window, which is unbelievably dangerous. And I have literally pulled up beside those people and asked them what in the world is going through their mind, and do they realize that they could wipe out this entire region from here to LA with one cigarette butt? Most of them are young people dressed up like gangsters, sitting down low in their seats, smoking and drinking and eating things that don't inspire spiritual evolution, and they're not even conscious enough to understand what fire is. But as a simple application, if everybody in the world were to throw a lit cigarette butt out the window at the same time, there would be about 7 billion cigarette butts all over the place. And just ask yourself, would the world be a more beautiful place? Would the air be better? Would it pollute the earth? Would it be a good example to the children? I mean, you don't need a lot of brain cells holding hands to apply that approach to living more spiritually. The next one is for parents. When challenged in a relationship, ask yourself how you'd like to see your children handle the same situation when it arises in their life. If your kids are challenging you, it's easy to fly off the handle, get caustic with words and criticisms and yelling and screaming and all sorts of things, whipping and beatings and you name it. But remember, our children are they're going to come back to us for help for a long time. I have a son that's almost 40. I've got experience here. I've got a 3-year-old. I've got a new one on the way. I've been around long enough to see what really goes on. So if we handle ourselves with our children the way we would like to see them handle themselves in their relationships, we will contribute to the evolution of everyone very quickly and the planet. We will evolve spiritually and with that one practice. And if you apply the previous three to number four, it all comes quite clear to you, to anyone who's awake enough to see what I'm sharing here. Number five, are my choices and actions creating harmony or disharmony in the world? Am I funding healing or destruction with my purchases? The political system is so dangerously broken, it's really no longer anything but a government headquarters for corporations with nothing but profit in mind and obviously very, very little consciousness of nature or the future of humanity. Just what can we stuff our bank accounts with now? And so we, down at the ground level, have got the responsibility of controlling large corporations by realizing that we are funding their silliness, whether we like it or not. So we need to be conscious about what we vote for to the degree that that helps. We need to be conscious that everything we're purchasing is connected to some kind of a process. If you saw what it took to make a car, you'd be amazed. Most of you probably don't realize that it takes 3 times the amount of water the average plastic bottle holds to make the plastic bottle itself. So when we're buying bottled water everywhere, instead of carrying a bottle or using sources like findaspring.com, or not being conscious with recycling, I buy my bottle here in California where I live in glass from Palomar Water, and I get 5-gallon bottles in glass from a 4,000-foot artesian well from Palomar Mountain, which I'm looking at right out my window right now. Unfortunately, that's one of the few water sources in the world that's been tested and found no impurities whatsoever in it. So I'm really grateful to live here, and we got plenty of organic food right in this area. So, you know, when I spend money on water, I do my very best to put money into the hands that are making the most favorable decisions or the least negative impact on the planet. Now, when I'm on an airplane traveling, I have no choice. But if I lived even in New York City, I would do the research to find the best water that was the least that was the best way to spend my money and support the people that are doing ethical things with water. In fact, one of my clients is a quite wealthy woman, and she buys up water supplies that corporations are trying to buy and protects them so they can be protected for the public. And that's someone who's spiritually evolved, and hopefully she's listening to me because she'll know who she is. Next, am I leaving the world a little better each day than how I found it? And am I leaving the world a little better when I leave the world at the end of my life than how I found it? My goal is to leave the world a little better place than I found it, and that's what the Czech Institute and my whole life is devoted to. 7 is the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. I think if we got rid of the extra 990-something pages in the Bible and just repeated the golden rule over and over again until we all live that way, or the Torah, or the Quran, or even the Buddhist sutras, although the Buddhists seem to be far less violent and traumatic to each other in the world than most of the Western religions. Same with the Taoists, and same with Shinto and the related religions. But if we really truly just embodied the golden rule for ourselves and each other, the world would evolve spiritually much more efficiently. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And I'm going to basically bring it almost to a complete close here. I've got a punchline for you. But the first principle of Sufism, which is the mystical branch of Islam, and almost all the mystical branches are where the real teachings are at, by the way, hiding behind all the fundamentalism in every branch, every denomination of religion, there are mystics, mystical Christianity, mystical Islam is the Sufis, mystical Judaism, the study of Kabbalah, which is just phenomenal and mind-blowing. If you haven't seen Mystery Teachings by Dr. Teresa Bullard on Gaia TV, get ready to get your mind blown by a truly spiritual, beautiful, loving, highly intelligent woman with a degree in physics who also is a master of spiritual teachings. And really, really, she's also an alchemist, and she's really someone who exemplifies what I'm sharing with you here, as do people like Joe Dispenza, Deepak Chopra, Dr. Dan Siegel, Thich Nhat Hanh, the Dalai Lama, Larry Dossey, Dean Radin. The list is long. The problem is that the great teachers and the great leaders that are truly spiritually evolved get very little airtime because we've got so much junk and corporate silliness in the way. But the first principle of Sufism, which is really my guiding principle, is this beautiful principle. There is no God but God. I worship everything and everyone. There is no God but God. I worship everything and everyone. And for those of you that just have no appetite for God talk, there is no source but source. I worship everything and everyone. And you get to the same place. So as we close, I want to share something with you that my soul taught me many years ago in deep meditation when I was asking, what is evolution and how far does human evolution go? And my soul said, write the word evolution down on a piece of paper. And I did it. And then she said, put a dash moving backwards through the word between O and I, and a dash between T and U, and a dash between U and L. And then she said, read it backwards. And it says, know it you love. Our evolution is concluded, and we return back to source, to unconditional love, when there is no it that we love. When we realize that we are not things. When we realize that we are unconditional love, and it is a condition. Remember, we talked earlier about subject-object. If someone is the object of your devotion, then they are an object or an it. Buddha warned us that desire for things keeps us on the wheel of samsara or life and death indefinitely. He warned us not to desire things. To desire life and to desire love is fine, but object possession is an illusion that leads to lots of problems. So we are all on a journey to realizing that all the its that we try to possess are all of ours because we are all one being. We are all one consciousness that's created the illusion of separation to allow life, love, and experience in time to emerge. Without time and movement, there can be no experience, and God can never know God. Source can never know its potential. So thank you for joining me today in our journey to getting to the place where there's no it that you love, but you realize it's all one beautiful, magical, mysterious process in which we can really enjoy not only the highs, but the lows as growth opportunities. Thank you for joining me. I look forward to sharing more with you in our final part of this series, Evolve Your Career. Lots of love. And remember those simple 7 steps I gave you, even if all this was heavy and heady, which I hope it wasn't. And just ask yourself, how can I leave the world a little better each day? And remember when Houston Smith was asked practically on his deathbed if he had a message he would like to share for the rest of us. He said, just be a little kinder. Just be a little kinder each day, kinder to yourself, kinder to other people, kinder to nature, and life will be more beautiful. So let's all just be a little more kind to ourselves and to each other, and spiritual evolution will happen. Aho, Great Spirit, lots of love.
Thanks for listening to the 4th Evolve session of Living 4D with Paul Check. If you'd like to ask Paul about how you can implement the tips and techniques you learned here, join him on Instagram Live on Saturday, April 20th at 12 p.m. Pacific Time. You can follow Paul on Instagram at paul.check to get notifications when he goes live. For more information on Evolve with the Check Institute, visit checkinstitute.com/evolve. Evolve 2019. You'll learn all about a powerful one-day event on May 3rd that will empower you to fuel your own personal and professional evolution. To listen to more episodes of Living 4D with Paul Cech, go to CechInstitute.com/podcast.